Back in the USSR, we'll be back after this short break.
You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM.
Cats Anonymous is holding their sixth annual Paws in the Garden Spring fundraiser on Sunday, May 27th at the Italian Canadian Club in Guelph from noon to 4 p.m. It'll be a fun-filled day of games, raffles, silent and live auctions, and a delicious buffet lunch. Tickets are being sold in advance for $35 per person. All money raised will support the 2018 Feral Kittens Spay and Neuter Fund. Please email admin@catsanonymous.ca or call the shelter at 519-855-6855. For tickets or visit www.catsanonymous.ca for more info. That's Cats Anonymous, 6th Annual Paws in the Garden Spring Fundraiser on Sunday, May 27th at the Italian Canadian Club, 135 Ferguson Street, a physically accessible location.
Conversations Worth Having with Kim Logue airs Sunday morning at 10 a.m. on CFRU 93.3 FM. With diverse and sometimes difficult themes and topics, from the silver tsunami and the healthcare crisis to food and water issues, you'll want to stay tuned. Sunday morning, 10 a.m. Conversations Worth Having.
Cats Anonymous is holding their sixth annual Paws in the Garden Spring fundraiser on Sunday, May 27th at the Italian Canadian Club in Guelph from noon to 4 p.m. It'll be a fun-filled day of games, raffles, silent and live auctions, and a delicious buffet lunch. Tickets are being sold in advance for $35 per person. All money raised will support the 2018 Feral Kittens Spay and Neuter Fund. Please email admin@catsanonymous.ca or call the shelter at 519-855-6855. For tickets or visit www.catsanonymous.ca for more info. That's Cats Anonymous, 6th Annual Paws in the Garden Spring Fundraiser on Sunday, May 27th at the Italian Canadian Club, 135 Ferguson Street, a physically accessible location.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM, CFRU. So before the break, of course, we had Damien Dempsey with his song, Irish folk singer Damien Dempsey with his song Colony. Of course, we had Norman Finkelstein talking about the current situation in Gaza with the Israeli atrocities perpetrated against unarmed demonstrators engaged in the Great March of Return. Palestinian people asserting their national rights to self-determination. In their struggle, in their struggle against settler colonialism in their homeland. And finally, on the show, we do have Donald Trump's decision to withdraw from the nuclear deal with Iran. I'm not really going to say much about this for now, but I want to direct you to an excellent article by my friend Greg Shupak on the website FAIR. And this, it's entitled Media Debate: Best Way to Dominate Iran. And as the name suggests, to this day America would love Iran to return to the days of the Shah, this American puppet ruler who ruled Iran very brutally for decades before the Iranian Revolution of 1979. They would love to return to the days when Iran was the empire's biggest client in the whole region, eclipsing Saudi Arabia and even Israel for a time as the mainstay of American domination in that part of the world. And once again, it's all about making the world safe for the Fortune 500, untrammeled access to Iran's oil, no nationalizations, no regulations, nothing. Just come in and take what you want. That's what the multinational, international capitalism is all about. Global capitalism is all about, is freedom to exploit. And they want to exploit Iran. They don't want any sort of nationalist government. Even a religious nationalist government is in the case of Iran, which is, you know, obviously very problematic and is engaging in abuses to its own people and has really been a quite right-wing regime. But nonetheless, it is a nationalist regime that looks out for Iran's interests, its national interests, and it regulates its economy. It controls large sections of its economy and does not want to surrender that control to multinational corporations and international finance capital. Is not a government that wants to surrender its sovereignty. Just like the government of Syria does not want to surrender its sovereignty, and just like the government of Libya did not want to surrender its sovereignty, and just like the government of Iraq did not want to surrender its sovereignty in 2003. You know, none of those countries backed down before imperialism, and some paid the ultimate price. I mean, imperialism is in action on a global scale. You know, like I said, it is the structure of the modern world. It's the highest stage of capitalism, as Lenin said. But through it all, it equally remains the case that, as Thomas Sankara, you know, the African revolutionary Thomas Sankara once said, he said, "When the people stand up, imperialism trembles." And the people are standing up. I mean, the Syrian people are opposing imperialism. The Yemeni people are opposing imperialism. Despite facing sanctions, military invasion, bombing, all kinds of aggression from multiple opponents, you know, who want to go in there and just basically destroy their nations, destroy their countries, they're still fighting back. They're still standing strong. And we need to be standing with them and not eating up all the mainstream media BS that we are fed on a daily basis, which tries to convince us that, you know, that, you know, those people who resist imperialism are basically bad people, effectively. Or they're somehow criminals or, you know, whatever. You know, like demonized in all kinds of different ways. We need to stand with those people who are fighting for self-determination. Against imperialism. Fighting for their sovereignty. Just like we're, you know, just like we support the sovereignty of indigenous people in this country. We support the people fighting against imperialism all around the world. Fighting against colonialism all around the world. And this is what we support. As progressives, we need to support. And one of these, I'm going to actually announce a event, because actually the next clip I'm going to play is from a man called Stephen Gowans. Now, Stephen Gowans, he's a Canadian college professor, and he's a progressive activist. He's written quite extensively on a number of different subjects. He has a blog. The blog's entitled What's Left. It's an amazing blog that he has, where he's written about so many different issues in the world today, from Syria to Yemen, to Korea, you know, all these things, really unpacking, cutting through the mainstream media lies on all these different topics, and even cutting through the lies about the Soviet Union and, like, different anti-communist myths as well. So he's done a brilliant job in so many different ways, like, you know, cutting through the, like I said, the BS about Syria. And that's the next clip I'm gonna talk about. It's a talk he gave a few years ago about, entitled Washington's Long War on Syria. But before I play that, you know, and talk about the history of American attempts to destabilize and enact regime change in Syria, which is nothing new, actually. It's been going back decades. But before that, I want to announce an event coming up next week with regard to Stephen Gowans. Stephen Gowans has a new book. It's entitled Patriots, Traitors, and Empire. And it's about basically imperialism, U.S. imperialism in Korea, on the Korean Peninsula, specifically looking at American aggression against North Korea. And this is a book he's launching on Thursday, May 17th. And there's going to be a whole book launch event taking place from 7 to 10 p.m. at 290 Danforth Avenue in Toronto. And this event is hosted by People's Voice, the Canadian Peace Congress, the Communist Party of Canada, and the Toronto Association for Peace and Solidarity. So, like I said, that event, that book launch, Stephen Gowans' book, Patriots, Traitors, and Empire, he's going to be launching that book on Thursday, May 17th. And the book launch is going to go on from 7 to 10 p.m. It's going to be 290 Danforth Avenue in Toronto. And like I say, that's hosted by the Canadian Peace Congress, the Communist Party of Canada, and the Toronto Association for Peace and Solidarity. So So like I said, that is definitely an event worth going to. I mean, he's an amazing speaker. He has, he's amazing talking about all these different, unpacking all these different issues. He does a brilliant job. So I would encourage you all to go if you can next Thursday. But without further ado, I'm going to play the talk which he gave a few years ago on Washington's long war on Syria. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
So this is a book, is a map of a complex territory that is the conflict in Syria. And a map never captures the territory in all its complexity. It doesn't capture all the contours, all the details of the terrain, all the hills and the valleys. But that's not the purpose of a map. A map, if it's any good, will be simple enough to be easily understood, but complex enough that the terrain becomes intelligible so that you can navigate the territory in all its variegated complexity. So the talk I'm going to give in the next hour, or less, is a map of a map. If the book is a map, a simplification, though a necessary and useful one, this talk will be even more of a simplification. A very rough map of the territory that is the conflict in Syria. But if the talk does its job, it will galvanize you to ask questions about the conflict, the answers to which you may find in the book. So let me begin by saying that, well, this book is titled Washington's Long War on Syria. The war is more multiform than the title suggests. It's not only a war between Washington and its allies on the one hand, and the government in Damascus and its allies on the other. It's also a civil war that has been going on since the late 1940s between Islamists and secularists, who have very different and ultimately irreconcilable views about how to organize Syrian society. The two major antagonists in this long-running civil war, the secular Ba'ath Arab Socialist Party, whose partisans are in power in Syria and have been since 1963, in other words, the current government, and the Muslim Brotherhood, Syria's premier organization of Sunni political Islam, which is the ideological antecedent of Al-Qaeda and ISIS, though the latter have been influenced by other forms of political Islam as well. I'll step you through an historical timeline of the conflict in Syria with its elements of civil war and interventionist war. In the mid-1950s, Washington conspired with London to purge Arab nationalist and communist influence from Syria. So their target was a triumvirate of Arab nationalist and communist leaders who Washington and London perceived as threatening Western economic interests in the Middle East. Spearheading this effort was a man named Kermit Roosevelt of the famous or infamous Roosevelt family, which gave us two U.S. presidents. Kermit Roosevelt himself is infamous for having engineered the overthrow of Iran's Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh, who committed the grave crime against Western domination of nationalizing Iran's oil industry. Roosevelt and the British Intelligence Service, MI6, planned to enlist the help of the Muslim Brothers to overthrow the three men in Damascus they saw as threatening Western economic interests. For various reasons, that scheme was not realized. In the 1960s, the Muslim Brothers led protests, strikes, demonstrations, riots, all kinds of eruptions in Syria under the banner of Islam, or Ba'ath Arab socialism, or to put it another way, Islam or secularism, always in opposition to what the brothers called the government's godless character. In 1967, the Brotherhood declared a holy war against Ba'ath Arab socialists, denouncing them as infidels and enemies of God. In the 1970s, the Brotherhood established an underground paramilitary organization anticipating the so-called rebels of today. The 1970s rebels were trained and armed outside of Syria, just as today's rebels are trained and armed outside of Syria by Western U.S. Western intelligence services in Jordan and Qatar. The brothers launched a major campaign of urban guerrilla warfare, assassinating Ba'ath Arab socialists, murdering state officials, killing army officers, attacking Syrian government offices, and assaulting Syrian military bases. In 1973, the Ba'ath Arab socialist president of the country, Hafez al-Assad, the current president's father, oversaw the drafting of a constitution that promulgated a mission for the Syrian state. The mission would be to foster the unity of the Arab world, to overcome its religious, its sectarian, and other differences, in order to achieve the Arab world's liberation from foreign domination, and to modernize and indigenize the economy. Modernization and indigenization of the economy would be accomplished through planning and public ownership of the commanding heights of the economy, what Washington and others would call socialism. Indeed, in Washington, Assad was denounced as an Arab communist. He wasn't a communist. In fact, he was suspicious of communists, and communists were suspicious of him. But from Washington's perspective, he may as well have been a communist, since his policies had implications for corporate America, which were equal to those of policies that authentic communists would have pursued. In the 1980s, Robert Baer, a CIA officer who spent decades in the Middle East, found that Syria was, quote, the epicenter of Islamic terrorism. Baer wrote, "When I first set foot in Damascus in 1980, I estimated that Assad had maybe 3 or 4 years before he went under. The Muslim Brothers owned the street. The mosque schools were teaching jihad. The mosque public address system blared out a message of hate and revenge. I figured the guy is going to get strung up on a light pole in downtown Damascus along with a whole lot of other people." That was Robert Baer. In 1980, the brothers established the Islamic Front of Syria, whose manifesto declared war without end until Ba'ath Arab socialism, that is, secularism, was exterminated in Syria. By the way, there are three things the Muslim Brothers and other Sunni sectarian political Islamists hate about Ba'ath Arab socialism. They are nationalism, secularism, and socialism. These are ideologies of European origin, foreign to the Muslim world, foreign to the Quran, and therefore foreign to God. Ba'ath Arab socialism, in the view of the Muslim Brothers, represents a foreign and godless implantation in the Muslim world, which must be exterminated. In 1982, the Muslim Brothers seized control of Hama, Syria's fourth largest city. They went on a blood-soaked rampage through the city, attacking police stations, murdering Ba'ath Arab socialists, executing government officials, killing soldiers. Every Ba'ath Arab socialist party official in the city was executed, many by decapitation. In the Syrian government operation to quell the uprising, the Syrian Arab Army captured more than 15,000 foreign-supplied machine guns, along with prisoners including Jordanian and CIA-trained paramilitaries. Well, likewise, insurgents operating in Syria today have been trained by the CIA and other Western intelligence services in Jordan and Qatar. In the 1990s, the Muslim Brotherhood established an alliance with other sectarian Sunni political Islamists to form what became known as the National Front for the Salvation of Syria, which perhaps would have been more aptly called the National Front for the Salvation of Syria from Arab Nationalism, Secularism, and Socialism. The Front had two goals. The most immediate goal was to assassinate Assad. The longer-term and fundamental goal was to establish an Islamic state based on the Quran. Let's jump to 2001. In the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, a retired U.S. Army General, Wesley Clark, told a reporter that during a trip to the Pentagon, he learned of plans to attack a number of countries. One was Iraq, which soon after was attacked. Another was Libya, which eventually was attacked, and a third was Syria. There were others, but Syria was among them. In 2002, Syria was added to the Bush administration's Axis of Evil, its regime change hit list.
Okay.
I have someone looking after me.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, we're playing Stephen Gowan's talk, Washington's Long War on Syria. Please stay tuned.
The Axis of Evil. The original members of the Axis of Evil were North Korea, Iraq, and Iran. In 2002, three others were added: Syria, Cuba, and Sudan, I believe. This was Washington's regime change hit list. Washington claimed that Syria was developing weapons of mass destruction and supporting terrorism, the same bogus charges it had leveled at Iraq, also governed by Ba'ath Arab socialists. And this was leveled at Iraq as a pretext to topple the Ba'ath Arab socialist government in Baghdad and to privatize an Iraqi economy which Washington denounced as socialist and was indeed, to a large degree, publicly owned and planned. Iraq had combined its oil wealth with public ownership of the economy and government guidance of the economy to produce what one former US State Department had called a golden age. State Department official. He wrote, schools, universities, hospitals, factories, theaters, museums proliferated. Employment became so universal that a labor shortage developed. The same former US State Department official wrote about Gaddafi, that by combining Libya's oil wealth with public ownership of the economy and planning, Gaddafi's government had enabled Libyans to, quote, live beyond the dreams of their fathers and grandfathers. Well, in 2003, following the US-British invasion of Iraq, the United States contemplated, this isn't widely recognized, but it's on the public record, it contemplated extending military operations in Iraq to neighboring Syria, but decided its hands were filled with the pacification of Afghanistan and with the pacification of Iraq, and that it would have to achieve its regime change goals by other means. The intention was to impose broad-ranging sanctions on Syria to do what sanctions are always intended to do, destroy economies. Destroy economies so that ordinary people become so miserable that they rise up to overthrow their governments. And the United States, being such a large economy, is able, through very simple measures of economic warfare, to destroy the economies of small countries like Syria. Sanctions are also useful for propaganda purposes. I mean, once you've ruined a country's economy, you can blame its economic difficulties on the fact that the government has, as the Syrian government has done, pursued socialist policies, or what Washington dubs as, or considers, labels socialist policies. The sanctions, as intended, devastated Syria. In October 2011, the New York Times reported that the Syrian economy, quote, was buckling under the weight of the pressure of sanctions by the West. By the spring of 2012, sanctions-induced financial hemorrhaging had, quote, forced Syrian officials to stop providing health care, education, and essential services in some parts of the country. By 2016, according to a leaked UN internal document, US and EU economic sanctions on Syria were causing huge suffering among ordinary Syrians and preventing the delivery of humanitarian aid. The veteran affairs correspondent Patrick Coburn, who writes for the newspaper The Independent, likened the sanctions imposed on Syria on the sanctions which the United States had imposed on Iraq from the early 1990s to 2003. Those sanctions, according to a UN estimate, had led to the deaths through malnutrition and disease of at least 500,000 children, more deaths than produced by all the weapons of mass destruction in history. As a result, two political scientists, John and Carl Mueller, labeled those sanctions of mass destruction, more devastating than the atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki and all the chemical weapons used in World War I. Largely unrecognized is that sanctions of this caliber have been destroying Syria for the past 14 years. I mean, we see the attacks carried out by Washington's proxy guerrilla armies. We see the beheadings and the eviscerations and the barbecuing of heads and the suicide bombings. But what we don't see are the invisible, but equally, if not more, devastating effects of sanctions. Significantly, the moment sanctions were lifted on the defeated Ba'ath Arab Socialist Iraq in 2003, they were immediately imposed on an unbowed Ba'ath Arab Socialist Syria, which means that from the early 1990s to 2017, for the last quarter century, the United States and its allies have waged a highly destructive campaign of economic warfare, the economic equivalent of a nuclear attack, first on Iraq, subsequently on Syria, and have done so because they are opposed to the Ba'ath Arab Socialist efforts to bring the politics and economies of the Arab world under the control of the people who live and work in the Arab world. Constituted the first means by which regime change was to be brought about. The second was to reignite the Islamist war on the Syrian state. In 2006, Syria's Muslim Brotherhood had at least two meetings with the White House, according to the Wall Street Journal. In 2007, the Muslim Brotherhood helped found the National Salvation Front. Also, according to the Wall Street Journal, the front met frequently with the U.S. State Department, the U.S. National Security Council, as well as with the U.S. government-funded Middle East Partnership Initiative. In late 2010, just months before riots were to erupt in the Syrian city of Daraa, marking the beginning of what would become known as the Arab Spring in Syria, but in reality was the beginning of a renewed Islamist insurgency. The Muslim Brotherhood voiced its hope for a civil revolt in Syria to oust Assad's so-called heretical government. Well, the hope that a civil revolt would soon erupt was realized only a few short months later. But this was an outcome that the United States and the Muslim Brothers had been working toward since 2006. But in early 2011, before the uprising in Daraa, as upheaval swept across the Arab world, all was quiet in Syria. And this perplexed Western news organizations. I mean, why were there demonstrations in Tunisia? Why was there tumult in Egypt? Why was there an uprising in Libya, but not the slightest evidence of distemper in Syria? So the New York Times and Time magazine dispatched reporters to find out what made Syria different. Why was Syria quiet? Well, here's what they reported. They said all was quiet in Syria because the government had broad support. They said all was quiet in Syria because even critics conceded that Assad is popular. They said all is quiet in Syria because Assad has, this is Time magazine, endeared himself to the population, especially youth. They said all is quiet in Syria because attempts to organize protests against the government had failed. Syrians, it seemed, according to Time magazine and the New York Times, had no compulsion to protest against their government. And you can confirm all this by searching the internet archives of the New York Times and Time magazine for the months of January, February, March, and April of 2011. In mid-March,
you're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, playing Stephen Gowan's talk, Washington's Long War on Syria. Please stay tuned.
2011, riots broke out in Daraa. They were violent. Some rioters carried arms, buildings were burned, vehicles on the street were set fire to. Even U.S. officials, according to the New York Times, quote, acknowledged that the demonstrations weren't peaceful and that some protesters were armed. And the mythology that would later develop about the origins of the post-2010 conflict, this became the protests were largely peaceful, which is an interesting way of acknowledging that they were violent while making it appear that they were peaceful. Eventually, the modifier largely was dropped altogether so that the story became the demonstrations were peaceful. But at the time, neither the New York Times nor US officials saw the protests as peaceful and acknowledged that they were violent. A week after the outbreak of violence in Dara, Time reported that, quote, there do not appear to be widespread calls for the fall of the regime or the removal of the relatively popular president, unquote. Well, that clashes with the narrative, the mythology that was subsequently developed. Over a month after the outbreak of violence, the New York Times' Anthony Shadid would report that, quote, the protests fall short of the popular upheaval of revolutions in Egypt and Tunisia. Significantly, Time would also report that Islam was playing a prominent role in the protests. So if we look back on the history, we have civil disturbances fomented by Islamists dating to the 1960s. We have an Islamist guerrilla warfare dating to the 1970s, culminating in the violent takeover of Hama in 1982. We have Islamists meeting with the White House, the State Department, the National Security Council from 2006, after Washington abandons plans for direct military intervention in Syria. And we have Islam playing a prominent role in the protests, which are violent and involve arms. Consistent with this, in 2012, the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency, one of many intelligence agencies in the U.S. intelligence community, reveals that the insurgency is Islamist and led by the Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the forerunner of ISIS. So we have indication after indication that the uprising was not a peaceful, secular movement for liberal democracy, but a renewal of Syria's decades-long civil war between Islamists and secularists, egged on by the United States and its allies, who needed a proxy to carry out a war because they could not intervene directly owing to their entanglements in Afghanistan and Iraq. Indeed, the Defense Intelligence Agency said that the insurgents were supported by the West, supported by the Arab Gulf monarchies, and supported by Turkey. So the standard operating procedure of U.S. campaigns of regime change is to reduce governments, Washington abhors, to a single individual who can then be denounced as a Hitler or branded as a brutal dictator or an animal or a moral disgrace and so on. But the enemy is not the individual. If Assad were to step down today and leave in his place a successor who espoused Ba'ath Arab socialist values, the war would continue. Indeed, when the Ba'ath Arab socialist Saddam was driven from power in Iraq, the military dictator which Washington installed in Iraq, Paul L. Bremer, immediately undertook a campaign of de-Ba'athification, as it was called. I think it was order number one, was the removal from post in the Iraqi state of every member of the Ba'ath Arab Socialist Party. Washington then effectively imposed a constitution on Iraq which forbids secular Arab nationalists from ever again holding positions in the Iraqi state. So the objective of Washington's long war on Iraq was not the removal of Saddam alone. It was the de-Ba'athification of the Iraqi state. Likewise, the objective of Washington's long war in Syria is not the removal of Assad alone, but the de-Ba'athification of the Syrian state. So let me close on this. A year after Muammar Gaddafi was inspired by the same goals that inspire the Ba'ath Arab socialists, and these are summed up in the party's motto: unity of the Arab world, freedom from foreign domination, and socialism. Indeed, there are explicit references to these values in the constitution Gaddafi crafted soon after coming to power. So a year after Gaddafi, inspired by the goals of unity, freedom, and socialism, was removed from power by Islamists, backed by NATO. And by the way, in the campaign to oust Gaddafi, Canadian fighter pilots quipped that they were Al-Qaeda's Air Force. The Wall Street Journal, here's the Wall Street Journal again, the Wall Street Journal revealed a year later that Western oil companies had agitated for Gaddafi's removal because he was driving hard bargains and insisting that Libyans benefit from their oil resources. Well, you know, U.S. companies, U.S. oil companies believe that the petroleum resources of the Arab and Muslim world should be used for the enrichment of their shareholders, not for the benefit of people who live in the region. But oil company executives are systemically and legally bound to hold that view. You won't last long as an oil company executive if you think that the interests of Libyans are superior to the interests of your shareholders. Gaddafi had the opposite view, that the interests of Libyans were superior to those of U.S. oil company shareholders. As a result, he was eliminated. He would... he was eliminated because the goal of U.S. foreign policy is to defend and promote the interests of the most consequential sector of U.S. society, namely corporate America. And corporate America, through multiple mechanisms, not least of which is placing its representatives in key roles in the state, exercises enormous sway over public policy in the United States. And public policy, therefore, reflects corporate America's interests. You know, I could direct your attention to the current Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, former CEO of ExxonMobil, or the scores of millionaires and billionaires and multimillionaires in Trump's cabinet. The cabinet of Barack Obama and preceding ones were no less interlocked with corporate America, and especially Wall Street. Indeed, the U.S. national security strategy makes plain that the goal of U.S. foreign policy is to create a global economic order that serves the interests of U.S. investors, banks, and corporations. The 2015 U.S. national security strategy is readily available on the internet, and I commend all of you to look at it. It's a fascinating document. You would expect that a national security strategy document would be about the military, but it's almost all about economics. It's almost all about the economic systems or principles or policies that ought to be adopted by other countries in the world, and how the United States, quote, can and will lead the world. This document says it's never a question of whether the United States will lead the world. The United States will lead the world. And it will lead the world on behalf of the most influential sector of U.S. society, and that's corporate America. A day before this book was sent to press, I read a short essay by a notable Canadian, Norman Bethune. The essay was titled Wounds. Bethune, for those of you who don't know, and not everyone does, was a skilled and innovative surgeon who was at the forefront in the fight for public health care in Canada. But he's mainly known for participating in two wars in the late 1930s. One was the Spanish Civil War, the other was the Second Sino-Japanese War. In the Second Sino-Japanese War, Bethune joined Mao's forces as a frontline surgeon in the resistance against the Japanese efforts to colonize China. It was in China that Bethune wrote his essay, and his essay was a meditation on the causes of the war in which he was entangled that produced the wounds that he was called upon every day to operate on. And as I read the essay, it struck me that what Bethune was saying in very few words was what I'd struggled in a whole book to say. So I quickly asked Robin if he could include a short quote from Wounds as the epigraph of the book, and he agreed. So let me read it to you. Are wars of aggression, wars for the conquest of colonies, just big business? Yes, it would seem so, however much the perpetrators of such national crimes seek to hide their true purpose under the banners of high-sounding abstractions and ideals. Well, today the high-sounding abstractions and ideals are expressed in the claim that the United States or the West has a moral obligation to act, that we cannot stand idly by, that we have a responsibility to protect, and so on. The most insightful part of Bethune's essay, in my view, is the last paragraph. He wrote, you know, what do these enemies of the human race look like? And he's referring to those who, in the hunt for profit, start the wars that create the wounds that he was called upon to heal. Do they wear on their foreheads a sign so they may be told and shunned and condemned as criminals? No. On the contrary, they're the respectable ones. They are honored. They call themselves and are called gentlemen. They're the pillars of the state, they're the pillars of the church, they're the pillars of society. They support private and public charity out of the excess of their wealth. They endow institutions. In their private lives, they're kind and considerate. But there's one sign by which these gentlemen can be told. Threaten a reduction in their profits, and the beast in them awakens with a snarl. They become ruthless as savages, brutal as madmen, remorseless as executioners. And when you read in the Wall Street Journal that Western oil companies had complained to the US State Department that something had to be done about Gaddafi, who had threatened a reduction in their profits, it's hard not to think of the pillars of society and respectable people of whom Bethune had written. Bethune ended his essay with this: such an organization of human society as permits them to exist must be abolished. And the overarching theme of this book is that Washington's long war in Syria can only be understood within the context of the organization of human society as permits these enemies of humanity to exist.
Yeah, yeah.
Listening to Back in USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. So that was Stephen Gowans with Washington's Long War on Syria. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to close out the show with another Canadian, in this case a journalist, somebody who's been on the ground in Syria, who's actually seen with their own eyes the struggle of the Syrian people against imperialism. And that's Eva Bartlett, who has also done a lot of amazing talks about debunking the lies about Syria, debunking the mainstream media lies about Syria. And this was from a press conference she did with people from the Answer Coalition and other anti-imperialist peace groups at the United Nations, December 9th, 2016. And this is what she had to say. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
On something that Sarah Flounders mentioned, which is that today in the General Assembly, the representative of my country, Canada, has raised a resolution which is not about human rights. It's not about the people of Syria. It's a resolution meant to point fingers and to vilify the governments of Syria and Russia. And this resolution relates to a UN Security Council resolution that was vetoed by Russia and China some days ago. That resolution pertained to another useless ceasefire in Syria, which would have no bearing on, bring no good to the people of Syria, and which follows a week of liberation of areas of Aleppo, which now amounts to about 95% of areas of Aleppo that have been occupied for years by terrorist factions. So at this time, when 100,000 civilians in these areas occupied for years by terrorist factions have been liberated, the UN, parties in the UN wanted to impose another ceasefire. And I want to remind people why these ceasefires are indeed pointless. The last ceasefire in September was from the very start negated by 20 main terrorist factions who declared they were not going to participate, and from the very beginning violated the ceasefire over 300 times during the duration of the ceasefire. And not only these terrorist factions, while the Syrians and while the Russians adhered to the tenets of the ceasefire, but the American-led coalition itself violated the ceasefire by targeting Syrian army positions in Deir ez-Zor, killing at least 83 Syrian soldiers in a prolonged attack that lasted nearly 1 hour and which enabled ISIS to overtake that position. So this is one reason why a ceasefire is pointless at this point in time. There is no faith that any of the parties that the US and Western leaders who have funded these terrorists, there's no faith that they can actually control the terrorists and get them to adhere to a ceasefire. And the people of Aleppo want Aleppo to be completely freed. And I speak having been to Aleppo 4 times, and this is the will of people in Aleppo. So on that note, I'd just like to talk about briefly, I've been to Syria 6 times since 2014, 2 of which were with international delegations, and 4 times were independently on a visa I applied for, paid for, and waited for. My trips have been self-funded or fundraised, and I've gone at my own risk and been able to travel freely in the country to areas I wish to travel to. I've been many times to Homs, to Malula, to Latakia, Tartus, Siyath, Sueda, and again Aleppo four times. And I mention these because I think it's important people realize I have, in, wherever I've gone, I've spoken in Arabic to the people I'm speaking with. What Donna, what Sarah have said, that the people support their army and government is absolutely true. Whatever you hear in the corporate media is the complete opposite. And on that note, what you hear in the corporate media, and I will name them, BBC, Guardian, New York Times, etc., on Aleppo is also opposite of reality. Aleppo since 2012 has been inhabited by different terrorist factions, among them al-Nusra, among them the so-called Free Syrian Army, which has committed the same heinous acts of terrorism as al-Nusra, as ISIS, as Ahrar al-Sham, as Nur al-Din al-Zinki, which beheaded a 12-year-old Palestinian child, and somehow is still deemed moderate. Since 2012, these areas of Aleppo, which have now recently been freed, their occupation by these terrorist factions has meant the greater Aleppo, the 1.5 million plus population of greater Aleppo, have suffered sieges denying them food and medicine. They've suffered for years a want of electricity and water, and they've suffered daily bombardment by these terrorists of mortars, of gas canister bombs, which are improvised and made locally, of water heater bombs, which are even more powerful and can level floors of entire buildings, of conventional weapons like Grad rockets supplied by the West, and et cetera. As I said, they've suffered these attacks on a daily basis, and even now, because there are still Western-backed terrorists in pockets of Aleppo, there are still mortars and gas canister bombs raining down, and people are still dying in Aleppo. This is another reason why the liberation and securing of these areas is imperative, because that will actually bring peace to Aleppo. Now, my colleagues here mentioned the nature of unity in Syria and the fact that Syrians see themselves first as Syrian before any sect. This is an important point because our media and the Gulf media has made Syria out to be sectarian, which is something the Syrians themselves have denied. But it's a tool to make people confused. It's a tool to make people believe that it's Sunnis against Bashar al-Assad, when in fact, bear in mind that Aleppo is overwhelmingly Sunni and is with the government and is with the army and is suffering from the terrorists who declare that they are liberating the city in Syria. Other points about Aleppo are hospitals in Aleppo have been attacked. I'm sure you've heard in the media that hospitals have been attacked. Well, this media is referring to the pockets of Aleppo that were occupied by terrorists. And they have manufactured stories, and I can give you a precise account. In April of this year, there was a hospital called the Al-Quds Hospital, which in a concerted effort, all media said was attacked and targeted and badly damaged by either the Syrians or the Russians. In fact, the Russians had satellite imagery showing that this hospital was in the same shape that it was in October 2015. No difference. Therefore, it was not attacked. Months later, The Guardian, which is a prominent British newspaper, actually said the Al-Quds hospital that it had alleged months prior to be attacked and destroyed was treating victims of so-called chemical weapons attacks. So even the media that is lying is inconsistent in their lies. But there have been hospitals attacked. I went to the Al-Dabit hospital, which is in Aleppo City. It's a maternity hospital. It was attacked on May 3rd, and three women were killed. You would think this would be something raised at the UN or by so-called human rights groups, but it was not. In December 2013, the Kindi Hospital was attacked and destroyed. It was the largest and best cancer treatment hospital in the Middle East. It was destroyed by al-Nusra terrorist truck bombings. And in fact, in recent media reports on Aleppo, again alleging Syrian or Russian strikes on hospitals, Fox News actually had the audacity to use a photo of Al-Kindi Hospital and allege that this is in eastern areas of Aleppo and that this hospital had been attacked by Syrian or Russian strikes. This goes to show how much the media has been lying from the very beginning about Syria and continues to lie. When I went to Aleppo, I spoke with the Aleppo Medical Association. They comprise 4,160 active and registered doctors. More lies in the media have said the last doctor in Aleppo, the last pediatrician in Aleppo. Of these over 4,000 doctors, 800 of them are specialists. So you can see that when the media talks about Aleppo, it's talking about areas that were occupied by terrorists. And it's completely negating the suffering and the will of the Syrian people in Greater Aleppo. When I was in Aleppo in July, I got a taste of some of the bombings by these terrorist factions. There was an explosion about half a kilometer away at Hattat Baghdad, and I don't know how many people were killed that day, but it was close enough that it was a massive plume of smoke. About 5 minutes later, an explosive bullet fired from an area occupied by terrorists landed about 15 meters away from where I was. If it had hit parked cars, I wouldn't be here speaking. A day later, a good friend of mine, his mother, was killed by one such explosive bullet. So this is just a small taste of what people are suffering on a daily basis. In November, when I was there with a delegation of Western journalists, including from the New York Times, LA Times, BBC, etc., on November 3rd, there were a series of attacks throughout the day with Grad missiles, explosive vehicles, and other explosive bullets and snipings. By the end of the day, 18 people, civilians, were murdered and over 200 were injured, including critically. We were at the Al-Razi hospital, which is one of the main hospitals, and we saw the maimed people pour in. And this was just one day of many of endless days in Aleppo. On November 4th, we were at the Castello Road humanitarian crossing. This was a day that was meant to allow the people in eastern areas of Aleppo that were inhabited by terrorists to evacuate. And this was not the first time. On prior occasions, the Syrians and the Russians had opened 8 humanitarian corridors to enable people to leave. These were attacked by terrorist factions heavily. Even that day on November 4th, the Castello Road crossing was attacked twice with mortar shelling when we were there and 5 times afterwards. Clearly, there has been political will and intent by the Syrian government and its Russian allies to enable civilians to leave, to minimize any sort of loss of human life. Clearly, the terrorists that declare themselves liberators of Syria do not want people to leave. They've been holding civilians hostage. And if you're following reports that are not BBC and that are not New York Times, you will see countless testimonies of civilians, of the 100,000 civilians who've been liberated the last week, saying, thank God for the Syrian Arab army that liberated us. And the terrorists were hoarding food. They were preventing us from having food. This is all documented. Also documented are that areas in these areas occupied by terrorists, including a school, were housing chemicals used to make chemical weapons. And you could see also the gas canisters that were used to make explosive gas canister bombs. In fact, even when I was in Leiramun, we saw a factory in one of the buildings that was used to make gas canister bombs. In Leiramun, we also saw evidence of the so-called Free Syrian Army that some people say doesn't exist anymore. The 16th Brigades was active there. They had a cell underground, 3 stories below, that was perfectly intact in spite of aerial bombings above ground. And I make this point because people talk about the destruction in Aleppo as if the physical destruction matters. It's the people that the Syrian government and the Syrian people care about. And the destruction in areas occupied by terrorists occurs because the terrorists are bunkering below ground, come up above ground, fire their bombs on civilian populations, and go back below ground. So I just want to address a few other myths. Some of the myths that have been about Aleppo and Syria in general have been that the Syrian government and army are starving the population. Again, I refer to testimonies of people, even people I met with in November. I met with a family of displaced people from Al-Halaq, which is north of Bustan al-Pasha, which was an area, both areas, occupied by terrorists. At that time, when I met them on November 10th, he told me that they had fled along with about 40 others on about 20 days prior, and that they had tried twice prior to flee, but they were prevented violently so from doing so by the terrorists that inhabited those areas. This is the case. These are the testimonies coming out of Aleppo now. People saying, we tried to flee, they wouldn't let us, they shot at us. There are also videos showing people who did manage to flee coming under fire and the Syrian army actually protecting them, acting as human shields. So that's to say that what we've been hearing in the corporate media is not depicting an accurate image of what's happening in Aleppo. The corporate media is saying that the Syrian army is attacking people, and until today, the corporate media is maintaining this, even though the exact opposite is true. I would ask you to follow the voices of people in Syria who, like my colleagues here said, they want you to speak the truth. They're tired of lies. They're very well aware of the lies that our media is purporting and that our human rights groups are purporting. They want an end to the violence. They don't want this war to continue. They didn't ask for this war. But as my colleagues stressed, Syria is a sovereign nation. It has the right to fight against terrorism. And we know that 101 of 193 UN member states have sent terrorists to Syria to slaughter and destroy. So Syria is fighting a war against terrorism. It's winning in Aleppo. And hopefully, Hopefully, either the terrorists will accept a deal to be transported out of Aleppo. Hopefully, they will participate in the Musalaha, the reconciliation, will lay down their arms, will take the amnesty offered to them by the government, and which has been taken by thousands of former militants. And hopefully, above all, the U.S. will stop supporting terrorism and stop funding terrorism. And hopefully this new bill will take fire, will be supported, and actually it will be impossible to fund and armed mercenaries from FSA, Ahrar al-Sham, Nur al-Din Azinki, and all the colors in between, because they're all the same terrorists. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Eva. Very informative. Thank you very much. Now we are open to questions, if there are questions. The gentleman.
Hi, I'm Blenders Bublik, and I listen to CFRU to hear a mix of local content that I'm not going to hear anywhere else. I'm CFRU. Are you?
Cats Anonymous is holding their 6th annual Paws in the Garden Spring fundraiser on Sunday, May 27th at the Italian Canadian Club in Guelph from noon to 4 p.m. It'll be a fun-filled day of games, raffles, silent and live auctions, and a delicious buffet lunch. Tickets are being sold in advance for $35 per person. All money raised will support the 2018 Feral Kittens Spay and Neuter Fund. Please email admin@catsanonymous.ca or call the shelter at 519-855-6855. For tickets or visit www.catsanonymous.ca for more info. That's Cats Anonymous 6th annual Paws in the Garden Spring fundraiser on Sunday, May 27th at the Italian Canadian Club, 135 Ferguson Street, a physically accessible location.
Conversations Worth Having with Kim Loeb airs Sunday morning at 10 a.m. on CFRU 93.3 FM. With diverse and sometimes difficult themes and topics, from the silver tsunami and the healthcare crisis to food and water issues, you'll want to stay tuned. Sunday morning, 10 a.m. Conversations Worth Having.
The Alzheimer's Society of Waterloo Wellington is looking for people to help out with their music project. Studies have demonstrated overwhelming evidence of the beneficial effects of music and stimulation on people living with dementia. The music project provides a free-of-charge iPod with a personalized playlist to individuals living with dementia. The Alzheimer's Society of Waterloo Wellington is looking for volunteers to help with tech, iPod setup, and creating playlists. They are also looking for folks to donate old iPods, iTunes gift cards, or money. $75 gets an iPod Shuffle, and $150 gets an iPod Touch. Other MP3 players are also welcome. For more information or to get involved, visit alzheimerww.ca/musicproject. But I understand if there
is something. CFRU Archive.
You are listening to CFRU 93.